Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
We just arrived at Leicester Station, and when you come out, you walk past a statue of Thomas Cook, and I was wondering why. So I looked him up, and I found out that in the 1800s, he chartered a train to take 500 passengers from Leicester to Loughborough and back again for a shilling, which was apparently the first train excursion, which means that Leicester is known as the birthplace of popular tourism. It's also where Richard III was buried under a municipal car park till they dug him up and put him in the cathedral. But these facts are as nothing to the things we're going to find out from our guest, who grew up in this city. Grace Petrie once went on stage at the Cambridge Folk Festival and introduced herself as a socialist, feminist, lesbian protest singer to roars of applause. And her songs do deal with some of the issues of contemporary society, but they can also be very tender, very heartfelt, and reveal her emotions. And we're so looking forward on this crisp, cold, sunny January day to walking with her in her home city. Hello, Grace.
Hello.
Oh, lovely to see you. We're outside your house now, I think, aren't we?
We are, yeah. Just about.
And it's a lovely day.
Miraculously it is,
but you're wearing a hat and gloves and a scarf.
Yeah, well, I'm doing up all my layers.
Because it's going to be cold, but sunny.
Well, that's the hope. It was a most inauspicious start this morning. The fog was so thick that I couldn't see to the end of the road, so I think we've done well, really.
Well, let's set off walking. Okay. Where are we going to go?
So I thought we'd go down the canal towpath. The Grand Union Canal that runs through Leicester. We're in the west end of Leicester. This is actually over the other side of the city from where I grew up. I grew up over by the Leicester University, which is where my parents both went. But we're in the west end, which is the more sort of, well, colourful end of town.
End. Okay.
Yeah, cheaper property over this way, put it that way.
And what about the canal? I mean, are we going to find a very picturesque spot?
I mean, it's a sort of proper working dirty canal.
Excellent. So we might find some disused shopping trolleys, that kind of thing.
We'll probably find some disused shopping trolleys. You may well see some narrowboats, people on boats coming up and down the canal.
And is it a walk that you do often?
Yes. You're going to get a complicated story of dog custody now. I've sort of been sharing the custody of Jack Russell with my sister for about
Frank.
5 years. This is Frank, yeah.
Frank, who became quite famous on social media.
He became very famous on social media, and as such, I've had to give him back to my sister because my ego couldn't take how much people always wanted to see Frank more than they wanted to see me. What a lot of people don't know about Frank is that I was sort of only temporarily looking after him. And then the pandemic hit and I couldn't go anywhere. Obviously, I couldn't tour anywhere. So he just sort of stayed with me for a couple of years. And now, fingers crossed, I'm kind of starting up touring again as frequently as I was. And he's an old chap, Frank. He's about 13 years old, so he's sort of in his winter years, and so he's kind of retired back to my sister's house now. So I'm afraid he's not with us today.
Are you missing him?
I am missing him. My sister lives in Leicester, so I'm glad that I get to see him quite a lot. But this is the walk that I have done many hundreds of times in the company of Frank.
Well, I'm glad to be following in the footsteps of Frank.
Yeah, be better behaved than Frank ever was.
So, Grace, tell us about growing up in Leicester. What sort of a childhood did you have here?
A very happy one. I'm the youngest of four children, which is how you end up with a spoilt narcissist performer as a kid, I think.
Watch out, you're sort of waving your arms about in the background, yeah. Saying, hello, take pay attention to me.
Yeah, basically. Well, also, I'm obviously still am very small. I was incredibly small as a kid. My siblings are all normal sized, so I was sort of working doubly hard to like get all the attention from these three gigantic creatures as I saw them. Yeah, but I went to school in Leicester. My mum and dad, they're both retired now. My mum was a social worker. She was the manager of a children's home, and my dad was a probation officer. So quite sort of
liberal. So the idea of public service was very strong in your childhood, presumably.
People have asked me before whether or not I sort of get my politics from my parents, and I think the answer is definitely yes. But I would say that we weren't sort of explicitly indoctrinated as children, you know. I mean, I think the ideals that my folks brought us up with are things I would now, I suppose, recognise as socialism, but it was just more sort of, you know, treat people decently and no one left behind and, you know, never treat anybody differently because of race or religion or sexuality or gender. I mean, these are things that I sort of think of them as just fairly
sort of basic, that's
automatic
the price
values,
of entry, isn't
but,
it?
Yes. Yeah, would that they were. I mean, particularly in this country at the moment, it's starting to feel like a very radical position, I think.
And the city of Leicester, which I don't know very well, I know about Richard III being dug up under the car park.
Yes, thank you for mentioning that, yeah. We're very proud of that. There's scarcely a road left in Leicester we haven't changed the name of to Richard III Road.
Yeah. I know about Thomas Cook starting popular tourism
course,
here.
Yeah.
But what should I know about Leicester, really, you know, if I wasn't just reading the tourist brochure?
Well, what should you know about Leicester? The longest uninterrupted terraced street in Europe, Tudor Road. The largest outdoor covered market in Europe. Walker's Crisps.
The biggest celebration of Diwali outside India,
that's
I
true,
understand.
Yeah. The biggest Caribbean carnival in the country outside Notting Hill.
And what did you do when you were a teenager in Leicester? Were you already involved in music at that stage? When did you take up music?
I was in a succession of quite terrible bands
when I was a teenager. You've got to tell us the names of them.
Yeah, one was called Amazing Grace and the Lost Boys.
Oh, good.
I know. Thank God they remained lost. And another one was called Blackjack. I say we were terrible bands. I was in a succession of bands with boys from my school who basically had learned how to play the guitar in an effort to try and get girlfriends, which was precisely the reason that I had also learned to play the guitar. And none of us were successful at all in that endeavour.
And were you always the front person?
I was, yeah. It's funny. They were quite sort of adamant that I shouldn't play the guitar and I should just sing in this kind of Debbie Harry sort of way. And I
Stevie
always,
Nicks.
Yeah, and I always kind of saw myself as much more of a guitar holder. You know, it's funny that these kind of sexist ideals of what a woman's place in a band is, they still do persist, I think.
And where would you play gigs? What sort of gigs would you play?
I mean, they weren't even really gigs, I wouldn't say. I mean, most of the time we were just did a couple of school concerts and stuff, but it was mostly just getting together in bedrooms and playing covers and things. I'm talking about when I was about 14, 15.
Yeah.
And then I got my sort of foothold in the Leicester gig scene when I used to do the open mic night at The Musician, which is a sort of legendary Leicester venue. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
No, I don't know it.
Yeah, it's still going strong. It's unbelievably survived the pandemic. It's quite off the beaten path of the city. And they used to do this open mic night on a Monday night, which was a little bit legendary, called the City Acoustic Club. And I think I started playing down there when I was about 18 on a Monday night.
Was that with songs that you'd written yourself?
Yeah, yeah, if you could call them songs, to be honest.
What, because they were early attempts, you're a bit embarrassed about now, are you?
Yeah. I think in the old days, you'd record a CD, and then I suppose once you're embarrassed of it, you'd stop selling it, and it'd sort of quietly fade away, and that doesn't really happen these days. You write something, you put it on the internet, and it's indelible, isn't it? But yeah, I mean, I sort of try and be philosophical about it. I think it's kind of nice to have a record of where you've come from. It's, you know, yeah, if you can look back and think, I was a worse songwriter 15 years ago than I am today, that's probably preferable to the alternative, isn't it, really?
Quite, than to be getting worse. At least you're going uphill, yeah. Yes. So were you writing about political issues then, about gender issues, that kind of thing, or were you writing love songs or a bit of both?
Yeah, well, I would say that to my mind, I wasn't really regarding anything I was writing as political. But I was emulating, basically, you know, pop songs that I heard on the radio, and I was writing love songs, and I'm gay, and I kind of always knew I was gay from a pretty young age, so the love songs that I was writing were, you know, about girls. And I was quite old before I came to think of that as in any way a political act. I mean, I'm very, very, very lucky with my family, with my parents in particular, as I said.
So it wasn't an issue to them that you were gay?
Not remotely, not remotely. Yeah. And I think it was such a non-issue. It sheltered me, actually, a lot. That, you know, I think I thought homophobia wasn't even really an issue until I was an adult, really, because I never had a moment's pause about telling my parents, about coming out to my parents. I just knew that would be fine.
So we've come down by the canal.
Yes, so this is the canal.
And we've got some Canada geese.
Yes.
Six or seven of them there, and some ducks.
Yeah, my partner is a bird enthusiast, and I am learning the birds a little bit as I go along. So I think you get some moorhens down here.
Coots?
Some coots, I think. Is it cormorant? Is
that cormorant, another?
Yeah,
you get
cormorants. Some cormorants down here.
Yeah. Herons?
I've never seen a heron down here, but yeah, the Canada geese are a big fixture. And a lot of the swans, you get some of the teenage swans that are still sort of dirty grey. And I am afraid to tell you that we are more likely than not to see one or two rats down the canal,
yes,
today.
Course.
So I hope you're prepared for Leicester's finest.
It is actually quite a beautiful sight, isn't it? Because of the cyclists coming through. Because the sun is very bright today and quite low. Mm. And so it's shining and reflecting off the surface of the water here, which is rather attractive. There's a narrowboat.
There is a narrowboat,
yeah.
I told you we might see a couple.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you? What about? How do we feel about
a song here?
Well,
yeah,
I'm
that'd
just,
be great. Yeah.
There's a really nice bench.
There's a really nice bench covered in graffiti,
yeah,
and an old cornflakes
an
packet.
An old cornflakes packet, and I think is that a gin and tonic?
Yeah, a gin and tonic and a fag.
So
you what a great
we've got
backdrop.
Everything, haven't we? We've got everything we
and,
could possibly.
You're gonna, are you going to sing a song from your early days? Are you going to sing a song
about?
Well,
that feels appropriate.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah.
What is it?
Well, it's called. I'm just thinking about the.
The surroundings.
The location to sing it in couldn't be better. It's called This Time Next Year We'll Be Millionaires.
Is this kind of what you were thinking about, like my dreams of stardom?
Yes.
When you were setting out as a musician.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I was working in, for years in Leicester, I worked in a bar. I worked in a bar called Firebug, which we would actually hit if we carried on walking in that direction for about 15 minutes. And it is a late license bar between the ages of 18 and 22. I spent a lot of time clocking in for a shift at 10 p.m. and pulling pints until 4 a.m. and then cleaning the bar down for an hour afterwards and finishing work at 5 a.m. and I don't mind telling you, I'm still on very good terms with the proprietors of that bar, but I don't mind telling you that it was a minimum wage bar job, you know, doing the graveyard shift, and I was kind of seeing gigs as the road out of that life.
And you were looking at pop stars and thinking, I could do with a bit of that action.
Basically, yeah. Yeah, that was the thinking behind it. So,
and as we stand here now on the canal towpath, some years later, how would it feel to sing this?
I mean, I think my little 18-year-old bartending self honestly wouldn't believe that I ever got to the stage of having music as a profession. That's all I ever was hoping for, really, and definitely at that age it felt like a million miles away. So this is a heck of an audience by those by those standards.
Mm-hmm.
every day. The goalposts move every day. Something new to prove. I'm not Lily Allen, I'm not Kate Nash, Billy Bragg or Johnny Cash, but I'm true. And this one's for you. So stick with me, honey, I'll see you right. One day we'll have so much money, we'll drink champagne every night. I'm not Katie Tunstall, I'm not Katie Lang. This ain't the best song anyone's ever sang, but it's true. And honey, it's for you. And this one's for you, this one's for you. For every show you've ever been to and when we're having a ball, I promise it'll be worth it all. And all those nights I'm pulling pints, trying to justify this crazy life. Well, one day, not too far away, we'll look back and say it worked out okay anyway. This time next year, we'll be millionaires. Won't still be sitting here playing to empty chairs. And Heating OK and all those magazines be saying they love your hairstyle but they hate my jeans. If they do, at least I'll be true. And this one's for you, this one's for you. For every show you've ever been to and when we're having a ball, I promise it'll be worth it all. And all those nights I'm pulling pints, trying to justify this crazy life. Well, one day, not too far away, we'll look back and say it worked out okay. Yeah, one day, not too far away, we'll look back and say it worked out okay anyway.
That's fantastic. Complete with ducks quacking.
Absolutely.
That was absolutely brilliant. Yeah. Thank you.
It's very funny to be seeing it on this bench.
and to be singing it, you know, it is interesting about the way when you've written a song at a particular point in your life and then you come back to it years later, does it take on a different feeling to you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it sort of sounds twee now, that song, you know what I mean? Because it sounds sort of like, oh, well, you know.
It's quite optimistic, isn't it?
It's very optimistic, but I think that my partner's a writer, and we talk a lot about the sort of mythologizing of the arts and the mythologizing of the touring life and how unhealthy that actually is, because I think it's bad for everybody's mental health. It's bad for the people who are kind of feeling like they're missing out on this amazing star-studded life, and it's bad for the people who are sort of living this life, which more often than not is much more about checking into a travelodge at 2 a.m. on your own on the motorway services and sort of feeling very alienated from the rest of the people in your life. It's such a naive take on everything, isn't it? That little kind of 18-year-old me writing this song, thinking, oh, you know, one day, if I ever make it and I get to be a musician, I'll just be the happiest person in the world and I'll, you know, drink champagne every night. And so it is, it's funny to sort of look back on it as a grizzled and grey-haired 34-year-old.
So when you were writing love songs about girls, did you worry about the audience?
No, I think, as I say, my parents just really instilled in me this sort of lack of anxiety about it, really, you know. That, and it wasn't until I was in my sort of early 20s and I was doing gigs quite regularly when somebody, I think, first said to me, it's so brave the way you just sort of sing about being gay like that. And it just hadn't occurred to me at all that it could ever be interpreted as such, you know, because, as I say, I was so strongly brought up to feel like there was no bravery involved in being who I am and that there never should need to be. So I wasn't ever worried about it. And I think it's funny because I've obviously gone on in my later sort of phases of songwriting to become a bit of a protest singer and write about politics in much more of an explicit and sort of deliberate way. I think representation and visibility is a very important political act. Rightly or wrongly, I do feel some sort of sense of responsibility to sort of be as visible as I can be, because I think, you know, when I was a kid, I know that it would have been very useful to me to sort of see more queer kind of icons in music, and definitely in terms of being a butch woman and seeing so few butch women in the media, you know, I think that's something that I now do regard as like quite political with a capital P.
And some of your songs must have been received by other lesbian and gay people as being a statement that they were really proud to see.
Yeah, I think so. I've had a lot of communications to that effect, particularly since I brought out the album Queer as Folk in 2018. There's a song in it called Black Tie, which is a sort of letter of kind of self-acceptance and a letter to my sort of teenage self saying there's nothing wrong with the way that you are, and being butch is fine and being gay is fine. And I've had a lot of lesbian teenagers get in touch with me about that, which is an immensely rewarding thing to feel.
And when you're playing it and people are bashing out the chorus with you, that must be a great feeling.
It's amazing. It really is amazing. Yeah, it's. I mean, I've played it maybe more than any other song, actually, and I still... Some songs, you play them a million times, and obviously you can't help going a little bit autopilot throughout them, and that one it never doesn't make me feel a bit choked up, you know, so...
What about politics, though? You've talked about...
What about it, eh?
No, but you talked
who'd sing about politics?
Making statements about sexuality and so on, but more generally, your socialist views, how did they develop, and what do you think was the root of their development?
Yeah, well, I mean, so I am 34 and a half.
And we're just going under a bridge, which is why it's gone all echoey.
Yes. I'm 34, and then the long shadow of echo. Aging through the reverberations of time. So I was in my very early 20s in the 2010 general election, which obviously lumbered us with a coalition government between the Lib Dems and the Conservatives. And, you know, I was working at the time, I was living in Sheffield, working at the Students' Union Bar, when it's sort of impossible to imagine now, but the country was swept up by something called Clegmania. Do you remember this?
What, you mean the scene in the Rose Garden?
Oh, yeah.
Before the parties in the garden,
there
was Nick Clegg and David Cameron.
Nick Clegg and David Cameron in the Rose Garden,
having a bromance.
But before the election, I mean, there was this sort of...
I agree with Nick.
This cause celeb for a while was Nick Clegg's Liberal Democrats, who at the time were... famously pledging to repeal tuition fees if they were elected.
And he was a Sheffield MP as well.
He was a Sheffield Hallam MP, yeah. And he made that pledge about tuition fees on the steps of Sheffield City Hall to a crowd of an enormous amount of Sheffield University students. And he picked up an awful lot of students' votes. You know, a lot of people did attribute those votes to that pledge. And of course, anyone who... was older and wiser and sort of knew British politics better than me and my sort of student comrades did, was totally unsurprised that what in fact happened was that not only did they not repeal tuition fees, but Nick Clegg was part of a government which in fact tripled them to £9,000 a year. And, you know, I was very young and I was very naive and I was very green, but I remember very clearly this sense that this system is meaningless if... they can just lie. You know, if they can just lie before the election, if they can just say anything to make you vote for them, and then there's absolutely no mechanism to hold anyone to account for those promises, then surely the idea of this democracy is absolute nonsense. And I remember talking to a lot of student friends about it, and I remember talking to a lot of my parents' friends and my parents and older generations about it, and this sense... that was very pervasive was, well, yeah, he, you know, he maybe lied about that, but it was really your fault for believing him. And I remember it being such a light bulb moment for me. So that was, I suppose, my entry into writing about politics. I wrote a song called The Emily Davison Blues, and my friend Tim and I, who I was living with at the time in Sheffield, we went and sat outside Nick Clegg's constituency office in Sheffield Hallam, and I sang the song outside the door, and we made a video for it and put it online and uploaded it to YouTube. And I think by the next morning it had been viewed a couple of thousand times or something, which was, you know, I didn't have any profile or audience or anything at that time, so that was quite an impact. And in the early days of the coalition government, it was an incredibly politically fertile time. You know, that generation of student activists in the wake of the tuition fee broken promise, there was all manner of massive response to that. You know, huge demonstrations. There was an NUS demo in 2011 where 50,000 students marched on London. It was overwhelmingly well organised and peaceful. And this was around about the same time that Occupy Wall Street was happening and Occupy St Paul's was happening. And, you know, it just really felt like...
change is going to happen.
Yeah, and my generation is going to be the generation that changes the world, right. You know. And then I sort of found out that my generation wasn't the first generation to sing that.
Well, I think about the role of music in all of this, because, you know, obviously there's a long and proud history of protest song.
Yeah.
Were you listening to other people from the past who'd written political or protest music? Were you ever influenced by Dylan or people like that?
Yeah, I would have to say not really, actually. I mean, I loved Bob Dylan, but I kind of loved the love songs and the poetry a little bit more than the more famous protest songs. But I think it's something that I did sort of get into, you know, in reverse. I mean, it's...
You got into it because you had something to protest about.
Yeah.
And you needed to say it.
I mean, I didn't know what a protest singer was. Somebody said to me, oh, you're a protest singer. And that wasn't a term that I'd ever heard before. And then in my sort of late 20s, when I kind of got more into the folk scene and I was writing more folk-inspired music, and I met people like Leon Rosselson and Roy Bailey and Peggy Seeger, and, you know, I was invited to be a part of something called the Anti-Capitalist Roadshow, which was a sort of collective of 10 or 11 artists.
That's Sandra Kerr. It was an amazing thing to...
It was,
...to be going
yeah.
on the road. I mean, we've had Peggy Seeger on this
yeah.
podcast. I mean, and I was pretty awe-inspired, you know, sitting talking to her in her living yeah. room. It must have been amazing to go and perform with those greats.
Oh, and you know, Sandra Kerr and Frankie Armstrong and Rob Johnson. I mean, it was all, you know, it's like every one of them on stage was like a absolute heavyweight titan of folk music. And then there was me, like the work experience kid on the end, you know.
And how did they treat you?
I mean, gorgeously. Yeah, I love them all. I loved Roy very much. Yeah, the wonderful Roy Bailey, who, I don't know, my grandfathers both died before I was born, and I had this relationship with him where I just sort of felt like he was the sort of naughty grandpa that I never had, you know. I mean, they all were just absolutely lovely to me, and I learned just a phenomenal amount.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. What sort of things did you feel you picked up from associating with people with that level of experience, not just in music, but also in campaigning?
Yeah, I mean, I think the songwriting, Leon in particular, Leon Rosselson, I think the ability that he has to distill a political issue to something that goes right to the heart of you, I think that's something that, you know, nobody likes to be shouted at, I suppose. And I think Leon has this incredible way of taking something that you might have read in the papers that you might have almost become desensitized to, and he has this beautiful way of connecting it to the sort of real life and heart and soul of human beings around you, you know, better than any songwriter I know. And, you know, Roy, I mean, all of them, I could stand here and wax lyrical about absolutely every single one of them, but I learned a lot about showmanship, I suppose, from Roy. You know, I think he had a gorgeous way with an audience. He had this way of making everyone in the room feel personally invited, you know. It felt like he was just doing it for you, and he was so thrilled you were there. And he had this way of making 5,000 people at a festival feel like the concert was just for them. And I think that's something that I've tried. I mean, I don't think I'd ever emulate the skill that he had at it, but it's something that I've really tried to work into my shows. You know, I think with humour and with just that sense of welcome, you know, that's the thing that I associate most strongly with him, really, was always feeling so welcome.
I should say, we've just come alongside a lock in the canal now.
Yes.
And I think this is Leicester City Football
this
Club.
Is Leicester City Football Club.
The Foxes.
Yeah. The Foxes.
We're right opposite them, and there's a outbreak of gulls and orange boys going across, and a weir.
Yeah.
You can hear the weir in the background, I think. It looks to me like a place where a song
could be sung.
And a song maybe that references
the
Leicester City Football Club.
The thing,
have you got
Matthew,
one up your
got
sleeve?
Just the thing, yeah.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah. Shadow of the redwoods down the golden
about. Didn't stop until we hit the Golden Gate. Oh, I have lived life beyond my years. Seen open roads with no end in sight. But my rambling heart won't be unchained from where it's anchored lies. And when the foxes squall, I hear the roar from my front door. And when the river soar bears me back to shore, then I'll run no more. Oceans meet at 50,000 feet. I've watched the black forest shiver beneath electric sky. I've seen the Rockies arise up into clear blue skies. And car foundations just 3 miles from where I'm at. Oh, I have lived life beyond my years. Seen open roads with no end in sight. My rambling heart won't be unshamed where it's anchored lies. And when the foxes squall, I hear the roar from my front door. And when the river soars, bears me back to shore, then I'll run no more. Beyond my years, seen open roads with no end in sight. But this rambling heart, it won't be unchained from where it's anchored lies. And when the foxes squall, I hear the roar from my front door. And when the river soars, bears me back to shore, then I'll run no more. I'll run no more. And when the river soars, it bears me back to shore. And when the river soars, washes me clean and pure. And when the river soars, it bears me back to shore, then I'll run no more.
Had an appreciative coot in the right key in the middle there.
BVs there from the Ducks.
So that's a yes. That's so fantastic because I'm so depressed all the time when I hear Americans singing songs that make their hometown sound really sexy and wonderful. And it's about time somebody redressed the balance when it came to Leicester.
Leicester's owed one, I think. Yeah.
And what were you thinking when you wrote that song? Were you writing when you were away from Leicester?
No, it's funny. I wrote this song just before the pandemic. I was on tour in Australia, and I'd never been to Australia, and I'd never been that far from home. I mean, I've lived in Leicester most of my life. I was born here. And I do have an enormous fondness for the city. I'm very proud of the city. And I was walking along here, and you know, that line from the chorus, when the foxes score, I hear they're all from my front door, is absolutely true. And there's nothing like it on a gorgeous match day. I'm not actually a football supporter, but there's nothing like the sound of the jubilant triumph of Leicester fans, you know, the way that it kind of rolls across the city. I didn't really mean to write it. I kind of dashed it off pretty quickly, that song. But I was thinking about, you know, I've had this incredibly charmed, incredibly lucky life where I've been able to go overseas and have these amazing experiences, and music takes me all over the world, and hopefully, you know, fingers crossed, if I'm lucky, it'll keep taking me all over the world. But there's nothing like being home, you know. There's nothing like, this is where my parents are, this is where my whole family is, this is where I was born and raised, and these are my people, these are my foxes, you know. Yeah.
It's a wonderful feeling, isn't it? And to sing it's here, I mean, actually, they should invite you to sing it on the pitch. Have you ever?
I mean, I'll pass that on.
I'll ring them up and see if I can get them to do that. I think you should sing it before kickoff, surely.
I think so, yeah. And I mean, on the record, I mean, it doesn't have the full effect here just with the acoustic, but on the record, I got my friend Steve Pretty, who is an amazing brass player and horns player, to put in these very, like, almost Match of the Day-esque horns in the chorus there. So it feels very... you know, so yeah, pass it on. Pass it, please do.
We'll try and fix that gig for you.
Yeah, that'd be great. That'd
and
be
what
great.
A great spot. I mean, what, isn't it lovely here? You know, with the sun shining. Is it? I suppose it can be a bit miserable if it rains here, but there's a big expansion in the water suddenly because it goes into two branches.
Yeah.
And there's reeds growing along the edge in front of the stadium, and the stadium is lit up in the sunlight. It must be rather great to walk down here.
It really is.
You know, you meet all sorts of different people.
You meet all sorts of different people, yeah. And in the evenings, when there's an evening match, the stadium's all lit up in blue. And it's really amazing, you know, it's really gorgeous to watch the way that it's all lit up from across the canal. It's one of my favourite kind of views in the city, even though you do meet some characters down here.
There's an old brick railway bridge here with the water reflecting onto the arch in a rather beautiful pattern. And some less beautiful patterns of graffiti all sprayed up the stanchions. Let's walk underneath it, because I think it might sound
some
quite
urban
good.
Urban artefacts here, I think.
Yeah, and you can see where the water's drained down under the archway here as well.
Yeah.
And you can hear the echo of us coming through.
And as you know, I've walked down here, like I said, most days, and it is ever-changing, the graffiti.
Are you always going to be a city person, do you think? Do you think cities are the way you would
perhaps
most...
Not. Perhaps not. I don't think so. Well, I found in the pandemic myself quite sort of possessed by a desperate desire to be near the sea. It never bothered me about Leicester before, that it's obviously the most landlocked city in the country. But just being kept indoors for 2 years...
Was that when you filmed that video of you standing in the sea singing?
Yeah. So that's
where did you go to do that?
That's at Haysborough in Norfolk. My partner lives in Norwich, and I'm moving to Norwich, actually, in the next little while. And we're going to rent for a little bit in Norwich, but the ultimate aim is to try and buy somewhere that's pretty much by the sea, on the sea. So, yeah, that's my hope, really. I find that it makes me just a lot saner, really, just being by the sea.
But not in it. I mean, just a bit, for those who haven't seen the video, you actually sang the song up to your neck at times.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that.
Into the sea.
I took a guitar into the sea that I had... You would not believe the number of inquiries I had about the health of that guitar after that video. But I'm going to let you in on an industry secret, a trade secret, is we chose that bit of the beach because it's normally immense waves and incredibly choppy waters. And of course, the one day that you go there trying to film a song about stormy waters is the one day that it was like the most serene day.
Like this canal.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the stillest day. So what I had to do is it looks like I'm standing up and I'm actually kneeling in the very, very shallow tide, because it's the only way that we could get it to even seem like there was any waves. So what I'm doing is I'm sort of lapping in the pathetic shallow waters at Haysborough. But it looks like I survived a heck of a wave. Right?
Well, I wonder if it was a sort of therapeutic thing after the lockdown that you were able to go and do that and immerse yourself in it.
Yeah.
How was the guitar, by the way? You know, because was it an expensive guitar that you took and it got full of salt water?
It was an inexpensive guitar, which the electrics in it had broken long before, and that's why it was the candidate for that video. But it was no worse than when it went in, put it that way. A little bit saltier, that's about it.
Let's walk through here then. So we're going to plough through the mud to take a turn.
Oh, it's not as bad as it sometimes is down here.
And where are we going now through this alleyway, muddy alleyway?
This is going to bring us out onto the Great Central Way, which is just it's a path that sort of connects one side of the city to the other. The song that I played before is actually called The Great Central Way, named after this walk. So,
Is this associated with the railway? Because the railway's a big deal in Leicester, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is. I'm showing my ignorance now. I think it's something to do with it. that's the answer to that question.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
I'm glad we've got you as tour guide.
I mean, if I was doing a pub walk around Leicester, I could give you a lot more information about
history of the different pubs. You've worked in most of them, presumably.
I've worked in a few of them, yeah. If you're interested in where you can get served alcohol at any time of the day, then I can tell you that.
Well, that's quite important.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Oh, there's some other great graffiti here on the wall.
Mm.
Beautiful colours.
Yeah.
Pinks and blues and oranges. And different people leaving their marks, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's quite secluded here, so presumably they don't get interrupted.
I think that's it, yeah, I think that's it. I don't know if you noticed that there was some people preparing to fish in the canal there as well.
Oh, really?
You do get some fishermen down there, yeah.
And we're turning away from the canal now, or are we just going to another branch of the canal?
No, we're turning away from the canal. It's just a cycle path, basically.
Right.
That leads from one end of the city to the other, but it'll loop us back round to the where we got on the towpath, just near my gaff.
Hello. Hiya. So I'm just going to ask you, Grace, is there a branch of IKEA in Leicester?
Why do you ask?
That's my method in my madness.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You have a song about it anyway. But,
I certainly do, yes.
But is there an IKEA here?
No. So my closest IKEA is in Nottingham.
Right, but you go there presumably from time to time.
Presumably I do, yeah. So the song that I think you're teaming up for, it's basically verbatim true, every word of it. Like, I basically composed in IKEA.
Well, composed in your head in IKEA.
Yeah, basically the words anyway, yeah.
And what inspired it? What was going on in your life at the time?
Well, it was after the end of a relationship and I was, you know, kind of feeling a bit sore post-breakup, and I have cohabited with many partners and then had the relationship end, and then it's kind of the worst thing about it is that you sort of feel like, well, I've got to kind of start again, you know, that you sort of build.
I have to go back to IKEA and refurnish the house.
Exactly, basically. And I was there on one of these kind of morose, freshly single trips to IKEA, and I realised that the only other people really in there, apart from people who were all doing exactly what I was doing, was, you know, blissfully happy new couples who are kind of filling their houses and choosing their furniture together.
A horrible
and
contrast.
Obviously, and it is a horrible contrast, and it also really made me think, like, all the singletons can't ever imagine being those guys in couples, and all the guys in couples can't ever imagine being single, you know. So it just made me think that what a beautiful little juxtaposition of the human experience that you see in IKEA if you care to look around at it.
It's such a wonderful insight, I actually have to say. Now, ever since I heard the song, you know, every time I go to IKEA, which I have been to, I'm like, oh yes.
Yeah. You see, you'll notice them now, won't you? Yeah.
Yes.
You'll notice them.
Well, it'd be great if you'd sing it for us.
I'd love to sing it for you, yeah. Yeah. Let's just let these bikes pass us by. It's Wednesday evening in IKEA. There's just two kinds of people here, and in my life I've been both. The new team's at the starting line, committing to each room design like it was a permanent oath. But that's not me. I know these aisles, and you can spot the ones like me for miles. There's no good-natured arguments on taste. I have no need to compromise these days. There's no one saying we've been here too long, and I get exactly what I want. Wednesday evening in IKEA, and everywhere I look in here, a new team's trying to make themselves match. But those couples sharing meatball tea don't notice all the ghosts like me back here alone and starting from scratch. So spare a thought, but for the grace of ever disassembling shared space. Now there's no good-natured arguments on taste. You know I have no need of compromise these days. There's no negotiations to concede. You know I get exactly what I need. What I need. And see those optimistic lovers picking duvet covers. I wish them all the best from the bottom of my chest. And if they follow the instructions, there's no reason their constructions really shouldn't last. But then who am I to ask? Because mine all fell apart, and I'm right back at the start, hoping I've not lost any fundamental parts. And I'm sure that I'll remember how it all fits back together, 'cause I know I'm not inadequately skilled. It's just that some things take two people to build. Wednesday evening in IKEA, there's just two kinds of people here, and in my life I have been both.
So poignant. I love that. And I love optimistic lovers picking duvet covers.
We've all been one, haven't we? We've all been one.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you think of what you do as folk music?
Oh, it's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Which is, I mean, sort of bedevils us the whole time, you know. Yeah. So people ask, well, what's folk on folk? How do you choose who you talk to? And
yeah.
But do you think of what you do as being part of a tradition, of being in the spirit of some of those musicians and some of those songs that have gone before?
Yeah, I do, actually. And I think, you know, I'm sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek at saying about the million-dollar question, because it is something that I have had thrown at me a little bit, trying to kind of work on the folk scene in Britain. Because,
well, some people come and say, well, you're not folk music.
Yeah, basically.
Excuse me, you don't have an accordion.
Yeah, I don't have an accordion. And also, you know, I mean, I think, as you know, we have this amazing standard of folk musician in Britain in terms of technical skill. And I've been lucky to play with some of the most skilled, you know, players on the scene. You know, I was in Coven with Lady Masri and O'Healy and Tito, who are all just phenomenal musicians. And I've, you know, felt very inadequate, you know, there with my three chords, basically, that I just kind of strum on the guitar and just make a lot of noise and hope people are listening to me. But I do think that, you know, there's room, I think, for both. I think there's room for that incredible, amazing level of skilled, you know, technical musicianship, of which we have an incredible standard. And I think there has to be room for what I would think of as the radical tradition of folk music. Traditionally, it was the music of working people. It was the conduit of working people to sort of speak truth to power. And I think there's got to be room for that in the English folk tradition in 2022, in a country that is so ravaged by inequality. You know, what is folk music doing if it's not pointing that out?
And I wonder if you're a bit fed up, as somebody who takes a left-wing point of view, about being marginalised, if you like, you know, because you've got a Conservative government that's been in power for many years. Mm. Do you ever give up and think, well, I'll just write some pretty love songs now and I won't write about politics?
Yeah, I mean, I think it... I don't know if marginalised is the word I would choose, but I think that certainly after the election result in 2019, I'd say that was probably my lowest political ebb. You know, I campaigned for the Labour Party before that election, and I did a month of benefit shows in marginal seats to try and raise money for the Labour Party. One wonders really how much worse we could have done if I hadn't bothered, to be honest. But I write what I mean, you know, I'm being honest when I write songs. And a lot of people sort of said, when this album came out in 2020, I think a lot of people were disappointed that there was what they might perceive as less sort of explicit political music on there. But it's tough, you know, you can't turn it on if it's not authentic, you know. And I think I do feel heartbroken, really, about the state of the country. I don't know what the answer is. None of my campaigning has worked, none of my songs have worked, none of my ideas have worked. My generation just keeps losing, you know. And
but I get the sense you're not giving up. I mean, I'm just thinking about the song The Losing Side, album is a very interesting song, because it seems to start from the Sarah Everard protests, women protesting about not feeling safe on the streets. But then it goes on to express a much wider point. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I was feeling overwhelmed and gutted and devastated, I suppose, in the wake of the Sarah Everard vigil. And the Tories at the moment are pushing through this bill, which will basically criminalise peaceful protest. Even the peaceful protest of one person can be deemed to be a nuisance by the police, and that will make that a crime. And, you know, these are like fundamental human rights that we are literally having rolled back in this country at the moment, and nothing that the left does or tries seems to be working. So all of which is to say that I did reach a point of like enormous despair, but I realised, you know, that as a woman and as a gay person, you know, I do have rights today that I only have because people came up before me and they fought for them, and in some cases they did die for them, you know. And I think, just to go back to where we kind of started this chat, I got into politics when I was basically not much more than a kid, and I had this massively naive idea that there was going to be this massive revolution and, you know, maybe I would be able to be the musical...
The Piper of the revolution.
Maybe, yeah, yeah. or at least the narrator of it, you know, like making some sort of record of it that might be looked back upon one day. And I think the truth is, now I'm in my mid-30s, I've sort of settled into an idea that politics is not a glorious thing. You know, it's a lifelong struggle, you know, like Mark Thomas always says, they don't call it the struggle for nothing. And to realise these things that I believe in, that I'm fighting for, I may well not win in my lifetime. I may not live to see these ideas triumph. But that doesn't mean that you can give up. Because if all of those people felt like that, if the suffragettes felt like that, if Harvey Milk felt like that, then I wouldn't really be where I am today, you know? And I think if the only, like, optimism that I can find is to feel like, well, maybe the only thing that I can do is add my weight to trying to tear down this wall while I'm alive, and just know that if nothing else, I might be like one brick falling, then at least that's one brick fewer for the people coming after me, for the generations coming after me. And I think we have to think like that, because otherwise how would we keep going? From common grief to Bristol up in flames, we came here begging justice and instead we got the blame. For peace disturbed out on the streets tonight, watching on the BBC, know something's not right. When mourners come with candles and with flowers, wrestled 3-on-1 and pinned down by the state's full powers. This is their world and these have been the rules. We have come to break it down with bloody fingernails for tools. This threat of violence, this tightrope wire, we can no longer bear it. We're all too fucking tired. No minute silent, we will sing higher. Don't tell us to light a candle when we have come to start a fire. And if I spend my life on the losing side, you can lay down, knowing that I try. There's a better world when on a quiet day, when I hold my breath, I can hear her say she's on her way. She's on her way. Safe at home, you watch it on TV. Never dreamed that one day you could be the enemy. That you might one day be under attack from all that should protect you, hoping someone has your back. The history books are screaming from the shelves that no government who outlaws speaking to defend ourselves has good things planned. A storm ahead, I see. Not one of us will bear it without solidarity. Oh, I see trouble all my days. This ailing, failing world sends signs of fire and flood and plague. But from the rubble, from the rays, the mightiest cathedral, from these ashes we will raise. And if I spend my life on the losing side, you can lay me say, take your heart, my sister. This fire will never die. And take your heart, my comrade. And no one left behind. And if I spend my life on the losing side, you can lay me down, knowing that I tried. There's a better world, and on a quiet day, when I hold my breath, I can hear her say that if I spend my life on the losing side, I can lay me down, knowing that I tried. There's a better world, and on a quiet day, when I hold my breath, I can hear her say that if I spend my life on the losing side, you can lay me down, knowing that I tried. There's a better world, and on a quiet day, when I hold my breath, I can hear her say that she's on her way.
Such a powerful rallying cry. Thank you very much indeed, Grace, and thanks for taking us around Leicester and showing us the sights.
Thank you.
And singing the songs.
I hope you've enjoyed it.
Oh, it's been
enjoyed
amazing.
Enjoyed our ducks and our graffiti and you know.
It's been brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Cheers.
The wonderful Grace Petrie in Leicester. And we have filmed all the songs that Grace performed for us in this episode, and we're going to add them to Folk on Foot on Film, which has more than 150 songs now that we've recorded on our travels around the UK. And you can get access to them if you become a patron of Folk on Foot. All you have to do that is go to folkonfoot.com and click on the Support Us button. We rely entirely on the support of our listeners to keep going, so if you can make a contribution, we'd be really, really grateful.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.